From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. There was once this Japanese boy named Saburo Keita who was sent to the equivalent of a juvenile detention center because he was misbehaving at school, fighting with other children. And one day when he was 14, he was taken to the doctor, and the doctors performed a surgery on him, and it wasn't until months later that Saburo learned that he had been sterilized. Now, Saburo, who's in his 70s today and uses a pseudonym in the media, is one of a number of Japanese people who have sued the government this year over Japan's forced sterilization law. Now, this is a law that was repealed back in 1996, but that was used to sterilize about 25,000 people with disabilities or who were otherwise deemed to be unsuitable to reproduce. Japan's law was based on the pseudoscience of eugenics, or the idea of improving the human population by encouraging some people to reproduce and discouraging or preventing others from doing so. It was most famously used by the Nazis as a basis to forcibly sterilize as many as 400,000 Germans as part of the effort to create an Aryan master race back in the 30s and 40s. Now, not many people may know that actually in the U.S., 32 states had similar laws allowing involuntary sterilization, and that about 60,000 people in this country were forcibly sterilized. Hundreds are still alive today, and in many cases, they're still seeking compensation. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at eugenics laws and forcible sterilization in both Japan and the U.S., two countries with a surprisingly recent legacy of sterilizing their people against their will. And we'll talk first about Japan. For this, we're joined by Sumiko Atsubo. She's a history professor now at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota, who's been researching this issue. Sumiko, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us in Ithaca, New York, is Kristen Roebuck, a professor who studies Japanese history at Cornell University. Kristen, welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, Sumiko, let me start with you. These sterilizations that took place in Japan over many decades after World War II took place under a law that was repealed back in the late 1990s. Why are we seeing lawsuits today in 2018 over this?
I think there are interrelated reasons, two reasons. One was recent availability of the document which is used as the proof to file the lawsuit. And the second was a long-term reason that the activists, feminist groups, and then also advocacy groups for disability, people with disabilities, they have worked on this issue for a long time. And because the government originally denied that, that they had records and unconstitutionality, and so the advocacy groups set up the hotline, and some of the victims who started the lawsuit were originally contacting the advocacy groups using these hotlines.
Well, Kristen Roebuck, what kinds of people actually ended up being sterilized under this law in Japan?
Well, the law claimed to be targeting, people who were eugenically unfit. And if you look at the provisions of the law, there's a long list of reasons that you could be deemed eugenically unfit. Everything from epilepsy to abnormal sexual desires, whatever that would mean. Deformities, different kinds of mental illnesses or disabilities, physical disabilities, and even totally non-hereditary conditions like Hansen's disease, or better known as leprosy.
And
so there were a lot of people who were caught up in this.
I mean, we talked about this this man Saburo Keita in the opening. What's the story of some of the other people, Kristen, who have filed suit about this?
Well, there's been this sort of belief for a long time in the eugenic worldview that maybe eugenics could be used to put an end to crime, and that criminality was somehow hereditary. So if he was misbehaving in school, then it's possible that a physician could think, you know, I can solve this problem over the long term by making sure he doesn't reproduce and have more bad children.
Well, Sumiko Atsubo, let's back up just a bit then. Tell us, how did this idea become sort of popular or widespread in Japan? Why was there a law passed about this sort of after World War II? It actually took place during the U.S. occupation of Japan.
Mm-hmm. So the original law, the National Eugenics Law, was passed in 1940, and it was recast in 1948 as the Eugenics Protection Law. And so both laws were about population control, and the original law was to restrict abortion or sterilization except for the hereditary disease cases. And then the second law, the Eugenics Protection Law, was to, I guess, deter the reproduction, and within the framework of eugenic ideology. And Japan lost the war and lost the colonies. So settlers are coming back to Japan proper. Soldiers were coming back from the battlefront and the baby boom. And with the devastated economy, how could we support that the population and population growth? So abortion was sort of made accessible. And also sterilization in the name of eugenics was retained from the pre-war wartime law.
So in other words, it sounds like during the war there was a law allowing for sterilization of people with genetic diseases, but after the war this became much more widespread, or the reasons where the government would be allowed to sterilize someone against their will became, you know, much broader. And then you also said that abortion became sort of wrapped up in this as well, because this law also provided, you know, sort of exceptions where abortion, which had previously been illegal, people were now allowed to do it. And Kristen Roebuck, talk to us just a little bit about sort of the genesis of these ideas in Japan.
You can trace eugenics back among the sort of intellectual elite in Japan to the late 19th century, when there's this wave of westernization in Japan. A lot of people are studying Western sciences, Western political theories, and one of the things you get from Western science and politics in that era is some pretty hardcore ideas about race and about hereditary superiority and inferiority. So people in Japan, it's most people outside this sort of very educated elite, don't get to know about eugenics until the early 20th century, when it becomes a much more widespread ideology. And so you see it developing maybe just a little bit slower than in the West, so that you have these laws passed in 1940 and then in 1948, whereas in Germany and the United States, these laws had been passed much earlier. And, you know, physicians and policymakers in Japan were specifically looking to Nazi Germany as a sort of precedent for this kind of law. And of course, Nazi Germany had based their own policies on American precedents.
Well, Sumiko, talk to us, if you would, under this law, how did the state make a determination as to who should be sterilized? Like, what were the procedures in place for determining who would get surgery and who wouldn't?
So originally in 1948, the physicians were supposed to form a group of eugenics review committee, and the cases were brought to them, and then they determined. But in 1949, 1 year after the enactment of eugenics protection law, they expanded this law to include the economic clause. Meaning, if you can't afford babies, then you are entitled to have abortions or sterilization. And so it became very liberalized, and then that means anything can go, and lots of people abuse this law. So it is not strictly constitutional, but for example, in the facilities for disability people, that people with disabilities, and then when girls became hit the puberty, then the menstruation is the issue. And for the caretakers, it was very difficult to take care of people who can't take care of their own menstruation issues. So therefore, they just forced the girls to go through sterilization. So many issues. Cases involved cases which are not hereditary disease related, as Kristen pointed out.
Well, Kristen, tell us, if you would, why. I mean, part of what's surprising about the case of Japan is that this law was on the books until 1996. It seems quite late. I think the last person to be sort of involuntarily sterilized was in Japan was in 1993. Why did it take so long to repeal this law?
Well, you know, there was a disabilities rights movement that really kicked off in the 1970s and started to win over feminist groups. It was a bit of a struggle at first, and so it just took some time for these people to finally manage to get a legislative success. And one of the roadblocks was, as Sumiko pointed out, once they introduced the sort of economic reasons clause that would allow women who felt any kind of economic stress to get an abortion without being prosecuted. The reality is that women and families and lovers started to rely upon this law as a way to control their own fertility. So they were very protective of the law, because if the law were repealed, then everybody, women and their physicians, could be prosecuted for abortion once again. That criminalization of abortion is still on the books. It was never repealed.
Okay, so sort of ironically, then, it sounds like women's rights groups actually supported this law for a long time because it provided a pathway for legal abortion, even as it also provided the government with sort of the means to sterilize part of its population involuntarily.
Exactly.
Well, Sumiko Atsuba, how has the Japanese government reacted to these lawsuits and to sort of this, you know, discussion of kind of a dark chapter in history?
Right. The first lawsuit was filed in January this year, and the government party politicians formed a working team, and the opposition party politicians also formed a group advocating for helping victims and locating documents in March. However, in June, in response to the first lawsuit by Yumi Sato, the Japanese government stated that there was no obligation for them to make the system to compensate victims, avoiding discussion regardless of whether or not sterilization was constitutional. But on September 6, the Ministry of Health, Welfare, and Labor released information about how many records documenting eugenic sterilization are available. And there are like lots of going back and forth, but all kinds of pressures from municipal or local governments asking the Japanese government to do something. And so just last week, on October the 20th, it was reported that the majority party working team was considering that the government would apologize without linking issue to the constitutionality or legality of the procedures. It would also determine detail of victim relief by the end of this year. It plans to submit a bill to be passed next year. So I think, you know, government was conservative, but they were moving forward to do something. But the constitutionality, legality, they were not touching on it.
Well, Kristen Robuck, our time grows short. But if you could look forward just a bit, where do you see this issue moving over the next couple years? I know that in some other countries, this issue has been resolved through apologies and through compensation. Does it seem likely to you that that's going to happen in Japan?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, there's more and more, I think, public support for this issue, which puts some pressure on the Abe government, which is very conservative. I'm curious to see whether Abe's government could bring itself to apologize. I would be a little bit surprised, because this is a government that has taken a stand against the liberal trend for apologizing for historical mistakes. And this is a government that strongly supports Japanese people taking more pride in their country and in their history. So I would be surprised if Abe were willing to say that this was, you know, morally indefensible and that Japan needed to apologize for it. But we'll see.
Well, Kristen Robuck, Sumiko Atsubo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the legacy of state-sponsored programs to forcibly sterilize, quote, undesirable people in both Japan and the U.S., a practice that continued well into the 1970s. We're going to turn our attention now to the U.S. and focus in particular on two states where people were forcibly sterilized as late as the 70s. One is California, where an estimated 20,000 people were sterilized by the state. Another is North Carolina, where a eugenics law disproportionately affected African Americans, some of whom received compensation for this only this year. So for this, we're going to bring in John Raley in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's a journalist and former editor for the Winston-Salem Journal, who's reported on this issue extensively. Also with us is Alexandra Stern. She's a professor of American culture at the University of Michigan, who studied the history of eugenics laws in the U.S. Welcome to both of you. John Raley, let me start with you. I understand that your reporting has shown that there were about 7,600 people forcibly sterilized in North Carolina from 1929 to 1973. And the government actually went ahead and apologized and agreed to compensate the victims of this policy. Who was the North Carolina government trying to sterilize and why?
Actually, through 1974. And what they were, it came about, it started in the Great Depression and based on the junk science of eugenics. But more than anything else, they just wanted to, hauntingly enough, just clean out the welfare rolls. They had a broad category called feeble-minded, where they would just go for just a wide scale of things that was based on faulty IQ testing. If a woman was promiscuous or dressing in men's clothes, epilepsy, a lot of this is the people talking about eugenics in Japan, is it just rings universally in a terrible way that just the broad range of people they would go for.
Well, John, can you tell us about one or two of the women who were sterilized under this program?
Yes, two of my friends, they've become my friends, Elaine Riddick and Nal Ramirez, were forcibly sterilized in northeastern North Carolina in the early 1960s. Each had had one child before the government got to them, and each, they tried to say they were feeble-minded, but that's certainly not the case, because, and they tried to say that they would never be good mothers and their children would be feeble-minded. And each of these women are very sharp. Nal went on 60 Minutes and faced down Mike Wallace after she filed her suit in 1973 and put him to shame. And both of them, the one child they had before the government got to him, both of them are very sharp. So it gives the lie to this whole program.
And John, who had the authority to make the determination that these two women should have been sterilized?
North Carolina's forced sterilization program gave unique powers to social workers, and social workers basically saw both of these women out and basically bullied them into finally signing consent to be sterilized. So there would be a group in Raleigh, a board that would basically just rubber stamp whatever the social workers signed up for on the petition. And the social workers just had woefully inadequate training for this. So it was just a sham.
Well, Alexandra Stern, if I could bring you in, let's talk about California's forced sterilization program. This was the largest in the U.S. I think it sterilized about 20,000 people. Most of these happened in the 50s or earlier, but this law wasn't repealed until late in the 1970s. How did this program compare to what John describes in North Carolina?
Well, California has a lot of similarities with North Carolina. California, North Carolina, and Virginia, for example, are the states that sterilized at the highest rate. California still was the highest at about 20,000. California's law, however, was passed relatively early. It was passed in 1909, and it continued unabated until 1979. The rationales for sterilization are very similar to what John has laid out and what commenters about Japan have also stated. So it was ideas of unfitness, of defectiveness, of inferiority. And really, you know, what underscored this was the theory that that these were hereditary diseases or conditions that would be passed down from a specimen of bad stock to the next specimen of bad stock. And that was really the kind of the underlying idea that motivated those who wanted to clean up what, you know, we would now refer to as the gene pool and to enhance society.
Well, Alexandra, where did these sterilizations take place? How, you know, again, how was the determination made as to who to sterilize without their consent?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a few differences, just broadly speaking. You know, in other parts of the world, like Japan and Germany, the sterilization programs were run from the federal government down. In the United States, they were implemented on a state-by-state basis. So as you mentioned, 32 states out of 48 at the time had these programs on the books. But the way they worked was a little bit different in every state. In California, for someone to be sterilized, they had to be institutionalized or on the path to institutionalization. So when someone, for example, was committed to one of the 10 homes for the quote-unquote feeble-minded or one of the, you know, quote-unquote insane asylums, they would be tested, given an IQ test, their family history would be taken, and based on the information that was gleaned there, which you can imagine was gathered with very much of kind of a biased perspective, sterilization would then be recommended. And another part that makes this forced sterilization, even though the sterilization laws were, you know, they were technically legal, they were on the books, even though we look back at them and see they're so problematic. But one of the ways in which we can see that is that in many institutions, release was contingent on sterilization. So the only way to leave the institution was to acquiesce to sterilization, and that was obviously a very difficult choice to make.
Well, John, you know, you have been part of this campaign in North Carolina for a number of years, and we mentioned that actually it was just this year, 2018, people are receiving their last settlement checks as sort of compensation mm-hmm. from the state of North Carolina's program. Why did it take so long for the state to sort of own up to this?
It was just a crazy mix of politics. In North Carolina, the Democrats created the program and then failed to correct it. And when we started, when we came out with our series in 2002, almost immediately we had a very strong state representative, Larry Womble of Winston-Salem, that started filing bills even in 2002 for reparations. And he was a Democrat, but he would just get lip service from his party. And that was when Democrats had the both chambers of the legislature and the governor's mansion, but just nothing. And they gave it lip service for years and years. And then we had a Republican takeover, both branches and the governor's mansion. And we thought our chances were shot for compensation. And then I thought it through and I decided that, you know, hey, this is if these conservatives really believe what they're saying, if they believe in the sanctity of life, if they hate big government and government run amok, then they should go for this. And so we just worked it and worked it. And finally, the Republicans did approve compensation.
And eventually that amounted to about how much per person?
They set up a $10 million pool. And so there were just over 200 that qualified. So that came to a little north of $45,000 for each victim, which is nothing. And no amount of money will ever settle the score for what happened to these people. They're haunted mentally and physically. But money is the way we settle scores in this country. So it was very important. It was symbolic. And a lot of these people live in poverty. So north of $45,000 is a good stroke.
Well, Alexandra Stern, just clarify some points for us. One, my understanding is that most of the people targeted, both in California and in North Carolina, were women, and that there's also a racial component to this. It wasn't merely about trying to, you know, sort of stop people with genetic defects from reproducing.
Well, I think the ideas about genetic defects were very racialized. I mean, they were understood in racial terms and in terms of disability and also in terms of sexuality and other aspects of behavior. So they all become bundled up in a way that's very pernicious. In California, like in other states that started eugenics laws, sterilization laws in the early 20th century, initially more men were targeted. That shifts over time so that by the 1930s, gradually more women are being targeted, and by the end of the program, it's overwhelmingly women, which is in keeping with the shift that we see in North Carolina, particularly by the 1960s, when it's very much disproportionately African-American women who are falling into the net of the sterilization program. In California, our research at the Sterilization and Social Justice Lab has shown that those with Spanish surnames, Latinos who were primarily Mexicans, were disproportionately sterilized at high numbers.
Well, John, really, let me ask you, do you get the sense that this idea of sterilizing people who society thinks are undesirable or unsuitable, I mean, is it finally dead and gone? I mean, to me, it was surprising that this happened so long after World War II. And yet I just saw an article about a judge in Tennessee about a year ago who was telling inmates, you know, I'll reduce your sentences if you agree to be sterilized for life before you get out of prison.
No, I don't think that it's certainly not dead at all. And I think there was an instance in, there's been reporting from California on people forcibly sterilized in prisons. So this is one of those ideas that must continually be driven to the light and exposed and fought. And this is why it's so important to have journalists like you covering it. It's a hard time for journalism. And, you know, the paper I worked for could no longer have the time and the money to put a team of five people on a story like this for 6 months anymore. So that's another big challenge to this.
Well, Alexandra Stern, our time does grow short, but I wanted to ask you, you know, just generally speaking, reproductive technology has advanced so much over the last 20 years. I mean, we're in an age of genetic testing and artificial insemination is increasingly common. There's even, I guess, artificial wombs are close to being a reality. Are there lessons that can be applied from, you know, sort of our history with eugenics, you know, in the technological era?
Well, I would say two things. I mean, responding to what John just said, I mean, as recent as 2010, it was found that women in two California prisons were being sterilized in unauthorized procedures, and that instigated a whole legislative process in California to ban that in the future. So, in some sense, the kind of sterilization of vulnerable subjects in institutions has not ended. At the same time, you know, the kind of genetics that was being implemented at the state level in California in the 20th century has become, we've moved into an era of genetic commercialization. That doesn't mean, however, that similar ideas about who is worthy to live and who is going to be a good parent have gone away. And I would say they have become more insidious. They've become more bound up in the politics of a reproductive choice, which is generally a good thing. But that's when we have to look at our societal values, particularly around people with disabilities and the way in which people of color are disproportionately institutionalized, and, you know, just some of the stereotypes that exist about kind of parenthood, children, capacity, and so on and so forth. So we're still very much living with some of these ideas and certainly with the legacies of eugenics today.
Well, Alexandra, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, but we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that there has been a bill in California's legislature to compensate victims of that state's forced sterilization program. Global Journalist is a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Alexandra Stern, John Raley, Kristen Roebuck, and Sumiko Otsubo. Our assistant producers this week are Chris Kroonen and Jai Shi. Yanchi Shu is our supervising producer, and Maggie Duncan is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer, Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.